Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I remember actually, you throwing a bike back at Joe Ehrlich at the British Grand Prix one year. It was a 250 that, if you remember Dr. Joe Ehrlich, who was quite mad, wasn't he? He produced those Ehrlich Motor Company bikes out of wherever he lived at the time. He was a madman. He actually sponsored Mike Harold once upon a time as well. And he gave Carl this really fast 250 that was doing the business in the hands of people like Graham McGregor on the TT and stuff like that. You had a go on it, and I think you got to Woodcut the first time and tried to throw you for the fence.
Yeah,
So he came and found me, of all people. He must have been looking for someone aged who could actually still ride. And it was pissing down with rain, and I qualified the thing in like sixth place in the rain. It was really fast. And then when it got to the drive, I thought, I'm on for one here. Carl's given me a gem of a bike, and I got on it, and it nearly killed me in the first lap of in the dry. Something completely wrong with it.
Yeah, he was a bit fucking nuts, he was, that Ehrlich. He didn't really like me at all. I don't even think he wanted me on the bike.
He used to order riders. They weren't allowed to have sex the night before.
All right.
Honestly, and you had to sleep in this motorhome of his.
There were no worries there with me, though. Yeah, he just, I don't know, somebody pulled out of the Grand Prix, I don't know, somebody must have got injured, I don't know. I it was the race which, you know, the last one before I broke my leg in 86, I rode the bike in the first practice, and he wouldn't even let me move the bars out or something on the bike. I said, no, this is Andy Watts rode the bike, and you ride the bike like this, I'm like, fucking dickhead. And anyway, just got on the bike, and it was just chattering everywhere. The front end was just chattering every corner, I just couldn't ride it. I said, can't ride that thing. And he didn't fucking want to do anything. So I thought, bollocks. So I went and saw the organiser and said, can I get an entry as myself and not with this idiot and race on my own 250? So I brought down in the back of the van. And that's when they kind of give me a lecture to not get in the way of one of the top guys. I was riding a bit wild at that time with a lap record and stuff I was doing in the British Championships. And so I rode my own 250. Yeah, and that's right, because he said, oh, Keith Ewan's going to ride it. I went, who? Never heard of him.
You have and, now.
Yeah, I remember your mechanic coming up and saying, what was wrong with the bike? I said, it was just chattering everywhere. It was a horrendous thing. So I don't know if you had the same problem with it.
The next qualifier...
You probably won't go as fast as me.
Well, that's probably true as well. I'll hold my hands up to that. I didn't hear Bertie then. I thought he was going to come straight into that one. But it was a great bike. It was very, very fast. But I rode it in the wet and then the dry. And when you rode it in the dry, it was a nightmare. Mm. How many motorbikes did you come across like that, though? I mean, the offers must have been fast and furious by this time in your career. You know, you were clearly the quickest guy in Great Britain, but you never really got that break. Ever the gentleman. I mean, how many offers did you, you know, way left of field kind of offers? Because at the time you were red hot. Back then, it was really, really easy to hire red hot people. You could come in with a bit of money. You could be from nowhere, left of field as a sponsor or as a provider, and try and hire a car Fogarty to do something like that. And you, knowing you like money, you always like money.
Yeah, who doesn't? I find it really hard, to be honest. Because obviously after the Silverstone Grand Prix, we're finishing 11th and that. I got a few offers then to go to Grand Prix, but then I broke my leg a week later, and then they just didn't want to know. So I was back with my old team, my own my dad, well, my sponsor was Apple Big Lay, Dave Orton. He was a big sponsor in the 70s with a lot of famous kind of riders, and he helped me. He bought my bike in 87, and 2250 Hondas. But I was just a privateer. I was still working for my dad at that point and stuff. And I had, like I said, I had a year or two in the wilderness, really, with my leg injuries. I was really struggling, to be fair, to get any sort of, you know, deal with anybody, really, to be honest. And I struggled until I won that TTF1 world title in 88. Then the Honda Britain helped me out and kind of was away then, really.
But
you know,
nowadays, people would see that kind of talent, see that raw talent that you had. We're seeing it all the time in youngsters through Spain, where it's coming from the CEV Championship or maybe CIV in Italy that might be bringing people through. Nowadays, they seem to be able to have the intelligence to spot that from far enough away. But the likes of yourself, and in latter times, I think Jonathan Ray should have been on a MotoGP bike. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And yet he's found himself, I won't say mired in World Superbike, but without the opportunity to do something on a Grand Prix bike when he should have had that opportunity. Do you feel you should have had that top-class opportunity? I mean, you rode a couple of 500s, but they were nowhere near really the team or the tackle to do the business.
Yeah, it would have been nice, to be honest. I mean, but superbikes became so big that I just got wrapped up in that bubble of how big it became in this country and a lot of other countries as well. It was just huge, and the GPs had kind of stood still a little bit, but I did, you know, I look back on my career now and, you know, some say I'm going to regrets, but it would have been nice to have a couple of years on that, the Marlboro Yamaha, which I'd spoke with Lucky Strike Suzuki a little bit and it didn't materialise. And then Marlboro Kenny Roberts wanted me to ride for him in 96. I had a lot of offers on the table after winning the World Championship for the second year running on the Ducati. And I went to Spain for the Grand Prix, the last Grand Prix of the year, to have a meeting with him. And he said, yeah, I want you on the bike and next year. So, but it's just down to Marlboro, really. I don't know if it was just bullshitting me or what, to be honest. I really don't know. But then I kind of got a call from his the team coordinator, Skip Aslan.
Skip Aslan, yeah.
He said, oh, Carl, you know, Marlboro don't want you. I said, I'll start smoking fags if you want. I'll do anything. And
said, so at that point, Skip dropped his trousers.
So that was it, and that's time for Honda. So, and I look back now, because that Yamaha would have suited me. When I rode the Yamaha at the Grand Prix, British Grand Prix, I just jumped on it and took to it like a duck to water. I was running fifth in the race on a privateer Yamaha, and then went fell off at Redgate on the coolant from Kaczynski's bike with about three laps to go. And that bike would have suited me, because I looked at people like Cadalora and Caparossi's, they were like, and, you know, Checkers, they were no better than me. They were as good as me, I think. They rode like me. They carried the corner speed. They were 250 guys like I was. And, you know, they all won Grand Prix. And I know I'd have won Grand Prix. I'm not sure that, saying that I'd won the World Championship on the Yamaha, beating Doohan. That would have been difficult, really. But I'd certainly been up, you know, up front at Assen and Donington, places like that on that Yamaha. It would have really suited me. I would have won a Grand Prix race, definitely.
So what killed the deal?
Marlboro didn't want a British rider on the bike, is what I was told. They didn't want they wanted an American on the bike, and full of it was Kenny Roberts' son that put on the bike. So I don't know if it was just bullshit or what, really. But so that was that sort of dream kind of over, really. But then it didn't really matter, because superbikes again was so big; it was huge.
But some of the top riders were in Grand Prix at that time. I mean, there must have been, you know, people that you looked at, focused at, and thought, I can beat these guys.
Well, I could, yeah. I mean, I beat him. I beat Creville twice in the British Grand Prix, and he went on to be world champion in 99. He was behind me somewhere in 93 and 92. It was only Doohan who was one to beat. He was special. He was a different class. He really was. After that, there were just Europeans who were like me, who could fast corner speed, Cadalora, was that kind of people, could win a Grand Prix or two, and then not have that aggression and determination week in, week out to really want to push like I had. It just as it was. It just didn't, my face didn't fit. I didn't probably, maybe didn't quite help myself at the time. I didn't look right. I didn't say the right things. And that was it, really. It was gone.
Doohan was amazingly anti-World Superbike. I remember having an argument with him and the Thistle at Donington Park over Superbikes versus MotoGP, because at that time, Sky were covering and bigging World Superbike up rather than GP, even though we were covering them at the same time. And he said, well, you're not interested in MotoGP, you're only interested in Fogarty and World Superbike. So you were getting to him, even from afar. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, definitely. We were getting so much coverage because of Sky, and everybody had a motorhome, and everybody wanted sort of English-speaking TV. So you had Sky, you had, you know, the Sky, the football channels and stuff, and and Sky was showing so much of our racing, or even the qualifying, repeating it during the week and stuff. So they were seeing us all the time more than they were seeing themselves on TV, to be fair.
I always wondered whether Scott Russell was going to be difficult for us as a broadcaster. When we came to Donington for the first time, bearing in mind that every time he fell down, I screamed, "Foggy!" as loud as I could do, and everybody loved the fact that you were giving his a good kicking. But I wondered whether when we arrived at Donington Park, whether his team would be okay with us as a broadcaster, considering how much we supported you. It's a bit out of fashion now because you're supposed to be neutral when you're a broadcaster, but we never really were. But the first time I met Scott, he came over and just said, he was as cool as, "Hi, Keith." Fist pump, job done. Rob Muzzy, though, team sponsor, wanted to throw me out the garage.
Yeah.
They weren't too happy with our support of our local rider. Oh. Did you enjoy our support?
Yeah, I loved it, yeah. Yeah, he was definitely pro me. It was amazing. Just like I said, we're doing adverts and all sorts, and you guys were screaming Reds off all the time when I was racing or making an overtake or whatever. Because I used to get back and I used to, you know, record it and watch it and stuff. I used to love it. It was amazing.
Do you remember when you did that big advert down in London? We shot real film, the stuff that you develop, not like video film that looks crap in about 2 years' time. We shot some really, really close-up, really wild film of you in a cage,
everything. I remember it was the advert for the 95 season that were sort of letting the lion loose out of his cage, and I was kind of rode through the smoke and broke through this kind of jail-like cage, and yeah, it was really cool. There was a lot of money spent on it. I mean, I think they were trying to shoot a video next door. What's it called? Van Morrison.
Yeah,
shooting a video next door. And like saying, "Look, can you guys be quiet? We're trying to fucking shoot a video next door with Van Morrison." We're like, "Oh, whatever, you know." Who was Van Morrison? I'd hadn't heard of him, to be honest.
We used to do a lot of work with you down at Sky at the time. And do you kind of look at what's going on now in broadcasting particularly and think it's a bit samey every single week? It's an argument I've had.
Yeah, it is. To be honest, I watch the racing every week and I know what time the race starts and I put it on 5 minutes before because I can't stand listening to all the bullshit they talk about. It's the same every week, you know. It's pathetic, really. It just bores the shit out of me, to be honest. So I just watch the racing and then flick it off. As soon as the top six have gone over the line, I flick it back over to Sky Sports or whatever, you know.
I wonder why that is. I mean, you guys probably pay for subscriptions and have got BT Sport or TNT or Eurosport and all the other bits and pieces. And it struck me over the last couple of years, since I've not been around and I've been watching it on TV, how little it changes from a presentation point of view. It's a kind of same group of people bouncing around in the paddock and the same questions. They're not really getting under it like it used to be. It used to cost a lot of money to do personal interviews, to go to Carl's house, to go and see, you know, you were talking about John Kaczynski earlier. I remember when we flew into Laguna Seca from London to interview Carl at a test. And I walked into Kaczynski's camp because, you know, everybody knows everybody. And I walked in there and there was these chocolate bars on the side. So I thought, that's bloody hospitable. So I took one out the middle of it. And about half an hour later, there was this screaming out of the awning because these were Kaczynski's bars. We told you he was mad. And I had now eaten one of his sequence of bars that he eats during the day. And he'd gone completely bonkers at everybody in sight, refused to ride his bike because some bastard had nicked one of his chocolate bars out the middle.
He had OCD, didn't he? He was like a proper freak with anything like dust or anything like that. I mean, we used to park motorhomes, me and Whittam. I'd save him a spot and park across from Kaczynski's, just watching, like, better than watching TV. He'd come out and he'd be washing a bunch of keys under a tap, just a bunch of metal keys, rinsing and washing them for ages. Like, it's a fucking freak. And no one were ever allowed in his motorhome. I always think, you know, I should sneak to his motorhome and just have the shit on the toilet. But not flush chain or anything like that. I got his Uber and spun it the other way around and fired all the shit out of everyone. It was a proper freak. When he crashed in the dirt, so it must have really freaked him out, that, when he got dust on him.
He's the only bloke I know that got given a new Ferrari, or he bought it. I can't remember. He was quite wealthy, so he probably bought it himself. But he had it covered up. Like, you just wouldn't do that, would you? Parked alongside his motorhome, it was covered up.
Really?
And another time we had to interview him, and we had to wait 3 hours while he debriefed. Can you imagine working for him? It must have been the hardest thing in the world. Ducati were working for him at that time. So we waited for him in his awning and he came out and he would only stand on this 1 foot square, 300 mil square piece of carpet. And I had to get down to his level And the cameras in those days were quite heavy for the, you know, camera guys were struggling a bit with it. And his feet stunk like you would never smell anything in your life. They were the worst smelling feet. So he might have had OCD, but he had the stinkiest feet out of any rider I've ever come across. And by the end of the interview, when we had to do the tapes afterwards, he had to cover it with loads of action because the poor old cameraman had been there for like an hour and his arms were shaking. He was down on his knees trying to hold the camera to interview the boy. You were never difficult like that, even though you probably argue you were.
No, I just love doing the interviews, really. You know, I would kind of get angry during the interview when he asked me about Kaczynski or Russell or something like that, and just my face had changed then, really. But no, I'm just wondering what you're doing that close to his feet. What were you doing, sucking his toes or something?
Mate, they were that bloody bad, you could smell them from where I was. Honestly, it was just the worst experience. Laguna, I mean, we always had a laugh at Laguna. You didn't obviously have a laugh at Laguna.
No, I struggled around there.
Yeah, but other tracks, I mean, what other tracks did you... What were your favourite tracks? What were your worst tracks? I mean, Laguna we've heard about.
Yeah, that was my worst one. Favourite one, Assen was my favourite. To be honest, the old Assen circuit was just built for how I ride a bike, really. The corners are all kind of banked. It would just help me, you know, carry corner speed, which is something I did kind of better than the others, really. That mid-corner speed and lean angle I would carry through the corners. It was just built for me as a rider, really. That circuit was... It was amazing. I liked a lot of the old circuits, like Salzburg. I love Salzburg. I love Monza. Circuits that they don't race anymore, like, you know.
Mega dangerous.
Yeah, and the old A1 ring, Zeltweg it was called, that was amazing circuit. Really,
well, we've
fast.
Just been there, the Red Bull ring as it is now, folks, but yeah, I mean, it used to be much longer.
Yeah, it was. It went, when you kind of go to the first corner and you go right, it goes up to that airport. It used to carry on into the country a bit and just go around these fast sweeping corners and then come back on a really fast corner where the open is now and then down that back straight. It was fantastic. So Hockenheim, the old Hockenheim that's gone, all the best circuits, they've kind of gone really. So
and that's really gone. They've dug it all up.
Yeah, all the old...
One of the memorable moments, of course, was you with a man in a bathrobe.
Yes.
Assen.
Me and my good friend Killy at Assen, yeah.
Anybody don't remember this? They didn't actually come together. But Keely thought they really had, that Carl had taken his line into the chicane.
But he wasn't mad about that, to be honest. I know what he was mad about. He was mad because I'd weaved around the stop. His bike was faster than mine. He rode for Ducati. Obviously, he was Italian. I'm thinking there's some sort of conspiracy going on here. He's got a better bike. He pulled out in the first race and just passed me down the straight like I was stood still and won the race. But he couldn't really lead the race there. I was really good, obviously, at Assen. I could lead the race, but I couldn't shake him off. And the second race, and I thought, he ain't going to come past me back down straight again. I'm going to fucking weave like mad. And I kind of weaved, and as he come around the fast, like a bit of a kink, it is flat out, and he was coming around the outside, and I kind of weaved, and I almost hit him. And I'd held him off. But then I made a mistake with a few corners to go, and I hit the wrong gear, and he come past me, and I thought, no problem, just stay calm. You definitely can outbrake him into last chicane, and I did. Came up the inside and banged into first gear, really slowed it down. Backed it in a little bit and got in and won the race. And I thought he was second. I had no idea. I thought he slowed down. I had no idea he crashed until I kind of came back round to like Chicania before he came in. And he's there and his bike's on the side and he's like going bloody mad and trying to take a swing and that. And I was like, what? So I just did the burnout in front of him, just piss him off. And I didn't go down well. And then he kind of carried on after. His manager, I think, got in his head, like, go into the press conference and say what you're going to say. And,
yeah, but in his dressing gear.
And he had a shower, and by the time we were in there, and, yeah, he come and sat right at the front, and I look at him, like sat here now, like, high up, and he's kind of, like, there on a bench right at the front, and he just kind of said, give me the mic sort of thing. What I want to say today, this guy here, he's riding dinner. I went, oh, fuck off, what is this shit? And I got up to go out and, you know, scuffled again and got a bit of handbags at dawn, and, yeah, that was it, really. And, he's kind of had a gone, really, and he lost his position in Ducati and everything, to be honest, and he lost his way. He's had any chance of winning the World Championship that year. I'd gone, and, yeah, we didn't speak for a good few months until the year after, and I always liked Killy, I always have done. I do now. He's, you know, my favourite guys from racing. He would be in my top three. I love the guy. I think he's a fantastic guy. He wears his heart on his sleeve, and he's very passionate and very emotional kind of guy, and... he said, look, this is silly. We keep not seeing each other in the paddock and, you know, let's put it all behind us and that's it. And, yeah, we kind of got on ever since then, you know. And, yeah, I wish him well, to be honest. He's not too well.
He's not well. That's a fact.
But, no, he was just boiling up that way because The three Ducati guys all could have won the World Championship that year. So could Hager, so could Aaron Slight, and none of us were riding that well. I were inconsistent, I were in and out of form, and my head had kept going, and I was complaining about my knee hurting, my back hurting, my motivation had kind of gone a little bit. And we all got a talking to. I got a bit of a bollocking off David Tarlatsi saying, you don't want this anymore, it's down to you, you keep blaming everything else, and I'll show you. So I really put it up the work in on the last three rounds and pulled it round and pulled the points back and won it. But in Assen, it was building up and building up because the two teams, the Ducati teams, didn't like each other. Virginio didn't like David, David didn't like Virginio. We got Troy and Killy and me on my own, and it kind of built up, and then what happened, it kind of exploded, you know, and went down to the last race then in Tsugo, and I did everything right in practice, and the races just went perfect from when I did what I had to do to beat Aaron and Troy and won the World Championship by about 4-5 points, and I was just so emotional. It was just so relief. It was just amazing, the feeling to win from a position I never thought I was going to win the World Championship in like four rounds before. I was way behind, and I came back, and yeah, it was very emotional, yeah, definitely.
It was for us as well. Back in the day, of course, the broadcast, despite the fact that we pretended we were at site, we weren't. We were always in London. All of the Sky broadcast was done out of London. None of it was ever done on site, so kind of we were cheating as we went. You mentioned Keely is in your top three. Who's the other two?
Mates, to get on, yeah. Well, Whittam, obviously, was... is probably my best mate in racing, and still one of our good mates, even to this day, he's one of my best mates. And I can't think of another ones, only two. There's no more.
Me. Oh, no. Second thoughts.
There was just nobody, really. I was okay with people. I just didn't really mate with them, really, to be honest.
How did you get on with other people's families then? Because, again, World Superbike was a family affair. Did you bother with other people's mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and all the rest of it? No, it didn't go that far.
No, not at all, no.
You really were probably one of the most single-minded people that there were in the paddock back in the day. Do you think...
You'd call it being a miserable twat.
Well, you could do, yeah. We won't hold it to a vote right now, I don't think. We'll leave that to a bit later. But, I mean, having got that single-mindedness, I mean, you obviously weren't that bothered about what people thought of you.
No, I wasn't.
Do you now, though, with reflection after all this time, I mean, do you now look back and think, fuck, I was awful?
Yeah, I said that before. I think, oh, fuck, why was I like I was, you know? I wish I wasn't like I was, but the people said, no, you had to be that character. You had to be that sort of person to make yourself go out and win the races. And I think they're right. So I don't really regret it in a lot of ways. I kind of wish I'd not said a lot of stuff that I said and been, but I don't think that would have been as successful as I was. I think it was in my makeup to be that sort of person then, to diss anybody that came sort of close to me, you know.
Looking in now then, are there other riders you think have got a similar amount of talent as you had back then, but who could do much better by being a little bit tougher on the attitude department? Right now, looking in, is there anybody in World Superbike, in MotoGP, that you think, with your kind of attitude, could do better than they're doing? I can think of a few, and I bet there's a few people in here that can think of a few too.
With the attitude and determination.
I mean, you watch it on TV now, like the rest of us. You don't go to any of the tracks because you. Why don't you go to any of the tracks for that?
I don't know, really. I just...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I'd prefer watch it on TV.
You get bored really quick,
yeah,
don't you?
I just get hassled to death, and I'd end up watching it on the TV in hospitality anyway. And I love watching it at home. I enjoy BSB of them all, the three, World Superbikes, MotoGP, BSB is my favourite, to be honest.
It's Jonathan Palmer and Stuart Higgs are going to be very pleased to hear that.
Yeah, it's just the way that it is, like the way that they race the bikes they race with the horsepower on the circuits that were built for Max Norton's in the 60s, like, you know, Alton Parks and Cadwells and sort of Knock Hills and Thruxton's. I'm like, how are they racing these bikes with these incredible horsepower around these circuits with obviously the traction control kind of off as well.
Yeah.
There's control, is a traction control. So they can still lose a rear, unlike Superbike and World Superbike and MotoGP, where it's you can never see anybody high side at all, really, in MotoGP. You'll never, it's always just lose the front end when they're pushing that hard, trying to make up little tents here and there. They lose the front, but they'll never high side again, lose the rear, because the bike sorts all that out for them, you know. Which
is that a good thing in your view?
It's not for me, no. I wish it was like, I wish traction control was like my day, was sort of your brain to your... to your right hand, that was...
That's what did for Casey Stoner, wasn't it? Casey Stoner left because of that situation, the overbearing electronics.
Yeah, I'd love it if they switched all electrics off and just sent them all out there. I mean, there'd be a few firing themselves off into space, but you'd be able to see who could really ride the best, who was the best sort of rider, couldn't you, really? I think it would have suited Rossi as well. I think he'd have had a few more years had it been that way, not all the electronics and stuff that are sorting the power delivery out of the bike when you're accelerating for the rear. So, yeah.
Do you sort of believe that the top guys would still be the top guys considering those kind of things, because they are pretty good motorbike racers?
It's hard to say because it's so close between so many guys in MotoGP. It's so close. It's all about sort of setup of the bike, really, not really down to the rider, to be honest. The Ducatis are definitely the best bikes to be on. I mean, there's three different teams in the first, second, and third places at the moment in MotoGP. I think if you all had the same bike sort of thing and you had the electronics switched off, I still think Marquez would be the one to beat, really, I believe, you know.
Do you think he should move the Ducati to Gresini?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Do you think he will?
I don't think he will, no.
I think he will.
Yeah.
I've got that feeling. Being a man who's moved through the years, and obviously it was injury that eventually took you out of the game, but Marc Marquez has managed to get over that at the moment, but he's now 30 years old. Girlfriend is now on the scene. He's going to fashion shows and doing a bit of the Lewis Hamilton type thing as well. Do you think all of that is a distraction for someone like Marquez, or is that him regrouping and trying to focus slightly differently?
I think it's probably a distraction, if anything. Only time will tell. I don't know. We'll see if he switches teams, because I'm not sure the Honda's that bad, to be honest. I don't really know. It's, you know, I'm not that close to it anymore. But I mean, his teammate was right up his backside one day at the weekend. John Mee, whatever it's called.
Joanne.
That's the girl's name.
Yeah.
Joanne Mee. So all these guys, they're not a girl's name. I don't know. I'd love to see him on a Ducati, because it really would make it interesting. That really would.
Do you think Ducati have got I mean, this is an argument that we've discussion that we all have for forever. Eight bikes on the grid, Ducati, two Hondas, two Yamahas. It's fairly easy to see now in an era of data and electronics that they have an advantage.
Yeah, they do. I mean, it goes around in circles, doesn't it? I mean, only a few years ago that, you know, Honda was the best bike to be on, and Yamaha was the best bike to be on, and Ducati were having a bit of a nightmare when Rossi was on the bike and stuff. So it's just their time now. It's, you know, and the others have got to catch up, and that's what it's down to. The others have got to put the work in to catch up.
When there's only a second between the top 15 bikes, 16 bikes half the time, 22 if you're in qualifying sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's not really down to the ride anymore. It's down to the bikes. The bikes are that good. They're that close together. It's the only way that the guys can gain a bit is on entry to corners, really. That's when they'll go too far and lose the front, and that's kind of what a lot of them do, lose the front. Like Bagnaia. He keeps making mistakes and losing the front when he's got the race in the bag or second place in the bag. He's pushing too hard on the front and losing the front, but...
Which, in this era, is the only place you can make up time,
yeah, it's
really,
the only place
it?
You make up time, yeah, that's what I'm saying, yeah. Whereas if you didn't have electronics on, then you were down to the rider to sort out the rear grip, you know.
Would you want to ride in this era?
Definitely. Fucking easy. I said to Whittam, said, you'd have been fucking great with traction control. You won the crashing push. You'd have been a world champion, wouldn't you? But yeah, it would be nice, yeah, for sure. It would be amazing, I guess. But I don't know. I kind of miss the old school. I guess I am old school and I miss it all a bit. But yeah, I wouldn't say no to it. I'll do it riding now, especially the money they're on as well.
Well, that's a fact. I told you, money orientated. Carl has always been really, really smart with that. I went to his house one day after his book was out, and in the garage was like several pallets of books, and he was signing how many a day?
Three.
How much a book?
I don't know.
I remember.
2 quid.
No, it's more than 2 quid, whoever said that. But getting back to the... I think you still get your book, by the way, can you? Can you still get it?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, and really?
I don't think
you better have a word with your manager. What was his name again? Baboon.
Yeah, Neil Bramwell.
Right? Neil Bramwell, known as Baboon. If you see him, you'll know why. So where is the advantage coming from in MotoGP now? I mean, do you agree with the tyre situation, single make tyres all the way through? Do you agree with spec ECUs, inertial platforms that they've got as the Magneti Marelli system? I mean, these are technical questions, really.
Yeah, too technical for me.
No, I mean, that's the question, really, isn't it? Is all this stuff just creating a problem down the road somewhere? Aero as well. I mean, would you like aero?
No, I'd love
that. Was aero, not
I mean, this is still the best looking bike in the world, isn't it? I mean, this looks like a brand new 2024 model. This does. Look at it. It's like just 25 years old. It still looks like a brand new bike. Well, now they look like fucking jet skis, don't they? Now with boats, don't they? With that many fins and stuff on them. You know, I don't know.
Jet skis. Have you still got your championship winning bike in your hallway at home?
No, I've got a good offer for it. All right, bad. I feel bad selling it. Some South African guy bought it for a lot of money, and it's in a museum in Germany now. It's his private collection, so if you want to see it, it's in Dusseldorf somewhere.
Is it? Yeah. I'm not going to go to Dusseldorf to look at your bike. I mean, you like a deal. I mean, there's nothing to be ashamed of when it comes to
you know what? I just look at the bike every morning I came down, and it's been left for 20 years more. And I just kept seeing it and thinking, it just reminded me of what I can't do anymore. And it was like leaking bits of oil and brake fluid and started leaking. I'm like, fucking, you know, what am I going to do with this thing? What are the kids going to do when I'm gone? They'll only sell it. So I thought, I'll beat them to it. I'll sell it. I've only ended up spending it on them anyway and buying them a shop in Clitheroe. So I don't know.
Well, let's talk about the girls for a minute, because, I mean, you're a very proud dad. Michaela's a very proud mum. And Danielle and Claudia have done pretty well. It's very difficult. I mean, everybody. How many people in here have got children? Virtually everybody, I'm fairly sure. I mean, and they are a bloody worry, aren't they? I've got 4 kids. You've got 2 kids. You know, it's a situation where you take a deep breath, don't you? Have you been like that? Has it been difficult for you?
They've been all right. They've been really good girls, to be honest. Really. I mean, my youngest went to Love Island this year, if any of you guys
know. How did that feel?
It was tough watching it. I've never watched it before. I've never watched it again. What a lot of shite it is. It's fucking terrible. Absolutely.
I thought that about The Jungle when you went in.
It's horrendous to watch, honestly. So, but when she was in there, it was hard to watch, to be honest. It really wasn't. And she was upset for two days in there, crying her eyes. I'm like, fucking hell, get her out of there, you know.
How did you feel there? I mean, did you want to go down there and sort them out?
No, and she came across really, really well, to be fair. She's properly like down to earth, had switched on girl.
This is Claudia.
Yeah, she's a really sound girl, really is. She's really a lovable kid. Everyone likes her. She's just that kind of personality. She's obviously not like me. She's stuck after her mum, you know. but no, she's done really well from the back, off the back. She went in just to, you know, help her sort of career, really, and get maybe in the media, and now she's like a... She's a massive following on Instagram and stuff, and she gets paid to do posts, and they sort of call it a social influencer now, whatever you call them. I don't know, it's a lot of bollocks to me, but she makes money out of it and does really well and does bits of TV stuff. And they both sound, they've both done really well, to be honest. And they've got a clothing company, a clothing label between them, two of them, called Sister Stories, which sell online, does pretty well for them. And the oldest one, she's married now with 2 kids, so she's pretty much a full-time mum now, really, to be honest.
How did that all come about? Not the 2-time kids, of course, I understand that. But, I mean, how did the whole thing come about with the jungle? And you went from bikes. How long was it between them calling you up? How did that happen?
They called me just after I retired from racing, about 2003, and said, would I be interested in... I kind of said no. I'm not. I felt like I was still the guy that raced then. I wouldn't have probably come across that well, to be honest. But then it came back to the ITV in 2007 or 2008. When was it? 2015. 8 years ago, whatever. And said, we want Carl to the jungle. And I went, fucking hell, I don't know. And they really wanted me to do it, the ITV. They really, I don't know why they did it. Maybe they thought they were going to get the guy that raced and was like single-minded and, you know, said it as it was sort of thing. I don't know.
But they did, didn't they?
No.
When it came to the games, they did. But you turned out to be quite a nice guy and won the people on side.
I mean, away from racing, I was always kind of an ordinary guy, really. And that's what came across, I think. That was just ordinary sort of down-to-earth lad who just liked to have a laugh and just go out with his mates and have a curry and take the piss out of himself a little bit. And that's what came across, I think, in there. But before I said yes to it, I was really annoyed about it. I didn't know. They flew me down to London and had meetings with the producer and that. And then they came up to my house. It's just because like, Mikhail was like dead against him. Mikhail's going, no, I don't want you to do it. You'll come across the right spot. I don't want you to do it. And I said, well, thanks for the vote of confidence, you know. They came up and said, look, your wife looks after really well in Versace Hotel and the kids and that. So I said yes. I said, tell Neil, my manager. I said, look, I'll do it. I'll tell him I'll do it. And I didn't tell Michaela, but she found out. She didn't speak to me for about 2 months. They were fucking great. Then she came round to the, obviously, I was going in and that was it. She threw a bit of a surprise party for me before I went. And, I got out there and, you know, I just put in a hotel for a week away from everybody else. I had no idea I was going in there with not a clue of anybody. And that first sort of 12 hours in there, my head wasn't right. I was just like, what have I done? What the fuck have I done here? I didn't need to do this. I don't need the fame. I don't need the money. I just, what have I done? I'm like, I'm probably getting panic attacks. I'm in this jungle jail with Gemma Collins.
Sure.
Unbelievable. Somebody out of Coronation Street. Who else was there? I can't remember. Who else. Vicky Michelle out of from Hello Hello. And two others, and I can't remember who I was in there. I was in this jungle jail, and then I kind of got the phone call. I couldn't sleep that first night in there at all. They're all snoring away. So Gemma Collins is snoring away. There's flies all around her. Everything. Fucking. Her legs open. There were flies everywhere. Anyway, I got the phone rang in the jungle jail, and it said, "Carl, you got to get your bag, you're going." And I'm like, "What have I done? I haven't even said anything yet." And your head's just going, thinking all sorts. Honestly, my head had gone completely. I hadn't slept for 2 days prior to that. I was knackered, and you come to the end of the gate, sort of thing. You went to a blacked out Land Rover, and you're going to do the first trial with Anton Deck. I'm like, "Fucking hell! Oh my God! What have I done? Why does everybody hate me already? What have I done?" You know. Anyway, it was the other camp had voted me. They'd seen my picture of the five campmates that were in this jungle jail and thought, pick one to get you the food. And they went, "Fucking that daft twat, he'll get us the food, Carl." So they picked me for that and they did the first trial. And I had to just get in a pit. We put a lot of snakes in on me. Now, they could have said anything to me. I mean, we had a gun. I was just like, "Oh, yeah, whatever. You know, if you want to eat that dog shit, I'll eat it. No problem." I just completely in a daze, and I got in and they're putting snakes on me. I thought, am I meant to be scared or something now? Or what am I meant to do, you know? And put about 40, 50 snakes in, and Anton Deck, "Oh, you're right." I said, "Yeah, I'm fine, you know, cruising." And then I kind of got out and did it. "Oh, well done, Carl, you've got all the stars and that for the camp and stuff." And then I felt something moved as I looked down. I thought, there's a fucking snake still in my shorts. I mean, it's like I got a hard on, and Anton Deck's going, "I thought you were pleased to see us." I'm like, "The fucking snake's still in my shorts, She got this, snake handler over. A girl come over, and she went,
"Oh, wrong one."
Put her hands up. But I said, "Make sure you get the right snake, girl." she pulled this snake out, like, "Fucking get it out, you know." And that kind of broke the ice a bit then. And I'd kind of come round, and then I went into the main camp then, met the others, and I kind of knew Jimmy Bullard. I knew Melly Sykes, and I was away then. I was, I threw myself into it, and I got on well with Kendra, the Playboy girl, which she would do, to be honest, I suppose. I remember having a shower with her at one point, thinking, "She's fucking great, this." I'm having a shower with a fucking Playboy bunny, you know, washing my ass and that, checking, "Did my ass clean the bent, Kendra?" And but to go all the way, and I thought I'd be out first. I thought I'd be the first one out, but I didn't care. I just thought, this is me. I'll be the first one out, and to go all the way. To win the biggest TV show in the UK, it's just fucking madness. I mean, no ordinary dickhead from Blackburn. It's just madness. So if you voted for us, cheers. King of the Jungle. It's the coolest title I've ever had.
He's still got bad breath after the ostrich penis, though.
It was camel's penis, actually.
What did it taste like?
Just hard and chewy and just fatty. Yeah.
Now you know how Michaela feels.
Camera lost on that.
Did you swallow?
Oh, God, I swallowed it, yeah.
Well, it must have been the camel's arse then, you ate, or was it the ostrich arse?
The cockroaches were the worst, and the mealworms, and the worst thing I had with the deer's blood, that was fucking awful, that was. I had to drink a half a pint of deer's blood, remix it with its heart and liver and eyeballs and stuff, and it was like, smelt, it was lumpy and gritty, and I had to down it, and we're like, it was everywhere, fucking everywhere, on my lips, everywhere, and I got it down. And I don't know how it stayed down. Dr. Bobby comes over, because after he'd gone off filming, he said, are you all right? I said, I feel fucking great, to be honest, mate. He said, look, try and keep that down. Try and keep it down. He said, it's the best thing you've had since you've been here. I knew what he meant. It was just 100% protein. I've had nothing but rice and beans. So, yeah, kept it down. The emotions were a bit loose the day after I went to the toilet. But yeah, that was awful. Like, I put me off drinking red wine for ages, to be honest. Fucking horrible.
You didn't enjoy that much then, by the sound of it. It sounded like it was bloody good fun.
One experience, it really was. I mean, I lost a lot of weight. I mean, I'm slim anyway, but I lost 8 or 9 kilograms, to be honest. And just to come out and to win the biggest show in the UK, it was just madness, to be honest. It really was. It was just the roller coaster of emotions when you're in there. Cut off from the outside world, you've not phones or anything like that, you've just got water to drink, boiled water, which is awful, really. It's just, you know, not no bottles of Evian or anything like that, it's just boiled water that you put in like an army canister to drink. It's like warm water, you boiled, and in 35 degrees heat, it was hard. It was mentally hard, it really was, more than physical, really.
When you walked across that bridge, Jake Quickenham finished in second place, I think. He was a good lad, he was, you know, quite a competitor for you. When you walked across that bridge and you were the king of the jungle, I mean, that's a domain that you're used to being, of course, number one. But from that point onwards, did it explode in your face? I mean, the media and the like when you got back out.
No, because I was in a really good place then, and really used to the fame from the World Superbike days and the TV coverage I got. I was a household name before I did the jungle thing. So I was at an age where I was a lot more sort of relaxed and mature about it and laid back about it all. And I could just come out and smile at everybody, thinking everybody must have voted for us. I was walking around with a smile on my face for the next 2 or 3 years, to be honest, thinking I'll upset somebody if I don't smile at them, you know, they might have voted for me. And it was fine. I could handle all that, the sort of media and stuff. And I got asked to do loads of TV quiz shows and also all the bullshit you get asked to do. And I've done them all. I've won Tipping Point and didn't do very well on Chase and didn't do very well on Celebrity Pointless. And
what was the one where you answered a coffee bean or something?
Oh, that was the weakest link. That was before. That was in 2002. That was just after I was retired from racing. Yeah, I didn't do very well on that one. Thanks for reminding me.
That's okay. Where do you think it took you? Was there anything after you come out of the jungle that you fancied doing? I mean, now you've been multiple world champions, talking of Formula One, F1, sorry, in bikes, World Superbike, Endurance World Champion at one point as well. I mean, FIM Legend, we forgot about that as well, because you've won so many titles that I've forgotten about. It's difficult to get across them all. But what happens at the end of all of that? You've now won the jungle, which was, you know, brilliant from a broader media point of view. What do you think about when you get out of there? What were you looking forward to doing next?
Nothing, really. Just being at home, just being me, you know. Just
could you do that? Could you do that easily?
Family life and go out with mates and stuff like that. Yeah, you got recognised every day of my life wherever I go, but it's still nice, really. I don't mind it, to be honest. I think, you know, the day no one recognises me, that's the day you'll get upset about it in some way. That's when you will bother, but everybody just sort of recognises wherever I go, and I don't mind it. It's nice. It's nice to be appreciated for what you do, whether it was riding a bike or doing the jungle or whatever. You know, still for riding a bike, really, is what 90% of the people remember me for. So
I think everybody in here appreciates how candid you've been with us, and particularly when you said earlier on how anxious your occasional depression comes. You've loosened up in the evening that we've been here. It hasn't been the beer, because you've only drunk one and a half. But you've kind of loosened up to
Yeah, I get anxious and nervous even out there before I come in. Even on the way down, I was like proper sweating, you know. I mean, and even though it's you and it's familiar and I know Chris and it's just, you know, an intimate sort of audience, that I still get the fear that, you know, that I'm not really wanted and not really liked. I kind of think really negative of myself and what people, you know, are going to think of me and stuff, you know. But when I get up here and I start chatting, I start kind of relaxing, and it gets a bit easier. So, yeah.
What do you look to in the future? What are you? I mean, obviously you're a granddad now.
Just staying healthy, to be honest. I've seen that many people around me just with different illnesses, and you know, and you said before, a lot of your mates have gone now, and it's just enjoying life. I'm pretty much retired now, to be honest, and I do stuff for Ducati Manchester Group. I'm an ambassador for them, and for Bikesure Insurance. I do a few chat shows like this, and that's it, really. I enjoy my time riding my mountain bike, going fishing, or going out on the dirt bikes with the guys, or going to Spain next week with the lads on the adventure bikes, and that's kind of what I want to do now. You know, just enjoy myself, and you're not here for a long time, here for a good time, really. You know.
In fact, I think you've pretty much covered that one fairly well. If you were giving advice to youngsters coming through, I mean, looking at the intensity that they have to deal with nowadays, and the it is absolutely consuming, isn't it? All consuming for youngsters. I mean, what advice would you give to youngsters coming up? Is there anything that you would...
Yeah, just say, pick up a golf club. Or a tennis racket. I don't know. Just advice. I mean, you've got to really want to do it for the love of doing it, really. You've got to really want to do it... because you really, really want to do it, and you've got to enjoy it as much as you can in the early stages, and try and be the best that you can be. You know.
So what's next for Carl Fogarty?
Nothing, like I said. I'm just, I'm off to Spain, like I said, next weekend. Got the bike show coming up for Bikesure Insurance Company. If you want an insurance quote, depends on my day, it might get a bit cheaper.
Or charge you double for his fee.
But that's it. No, it's just enjoying life, really. And like I said, just enjoying the things I want to do. It's go off a few holidays and in the winter do a bit of skiing. Hopefully my knee's all right to do a bit of skiing. And just try and stay fit and healthy for the foreseeable, really.
Carl Fogarty, ladies and gentlemen, he's been an absolute star.
And
he's going to continue to be one, that is for sure.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.